All right, now that the trade deadline is passed, I wanted to bring back Dylan Murphy. The Masters have been clamoring on Twitter, Dylan, for your return. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, we got a lot of stuff to get to here, and where I wanted to start is in talking about how the Wolves are going to look without Jimmy Butler. Now, news coming down after he suffered that injury over the weekend. He is to miss between 4 to 6 weeks. I've got a little bit of skepticism, either that A, it's going to be that long, that it could be longer, or B, that if he comes back sooner, that it's a great idea. We've seen that guys who really push to come back from those type of injuries before the playoffs, before what would normally be a 6 to 8 week rehabilitation for everything that we know about the meniscus surgery that he's having. It'll probably be a trim rather than a repair. If they're talking about that type of timeline, you go back to like Brandon Roy, Men of World Peace, as guys who came back on a short timeline, not quite as short or a lot shorter than we're talking about here with Butler. Those guys came back in like 2-3 weeks, but nonetheless, not something you necessarily want to push. But we want to focus more here on just what they're going to look like without Butler. And so, Dylan, what do you take away from like how they've looked without Butler on the floor here, and what do you see as the biggest obstacles they're going to need to overcome without him?
Yeah, so I mean, the biggest thing obviously is going to have to be Karl Anthony Towns picking up a huge offensive load moving forward here. And you know, we've seen this year he's taken a backseat sort of to Butler and Wiggins, but you know, with that void now with Butler, he's going to have to take up the mantle. And I think mostly that's really just going to be him on the block, just because you know, maybe they're not getting as much explosiveness out of their point guard play, so in pick and roll that kind of limits what he's able to do. And then really it becomes, okay, what actions do you run out of the left block or the right block? You know, if we punch it inside, what are we doing then? And if you really look at his post-up ISOs on the season, they tend to do what teams have done traditionally, which is you dump the ball inside and then the post shooter cuts through to the weak side, and then you have that sort of single side ISO with everybody else on the weak side. And I think they're going to have to sort of vary up how they get him the ball in the post and get a little more creative with those actions, because now there's really less punishment for them to throw doubles at him, both on the catch or after a dribble or two. And you know, even the best passers, it can be really tough to handle those doubles and make the right decisions every time, and it can be particularly deflating if you throw it away one or two times. So they're really gonna have to sort of get creative in getting him deep post position, not just letting him ISO with everybody sitting on the weak side.
Yeah, that's interesting. Thibodeau not known for a ton of movement. Would you agree with that? He kind of likes to just go to some of the bread and butter type of sets.
Yeah, you know, they run a lot of things you see traditionally across the NBA, but I do think Tibbs in general does run a lot of stuff. I think going back to Chicago, they are a coordinated offense in general, at least compared to many other teams, so they do have that going for them, which sort of allows for when maybe you don't have as much star power on the floor for the ball to keep moving, and you're able to manufacture ball movement that way. You know, ideally you want a team where they move the ball on their own and you get random and chaotic movement plus the ball movement, but some teams, they just don't have that gene, so you sort of have to push it out of them, and I think his teams in general have done that. But it gets tougher when your best player is at his best when he has his back to the basket, because that's really just an isolation. And so how do you work out of that isolation to get ball movement? You know, and that's always the question, right? It's, you know, if you're the Warriors or the Spurs or whoever it is, you know, ideally you can say, yeah, let's throw it into LaMarcus Aldridge or Kevin Durant 45 times, but at what cost does that come? And, you know, Minnesota's going to have to figure that out with Towns.
Well, I do think that the one thing about Towns that is underrated right now is his post game. We have not seen as much of that from him. But for me, and tell me whether you agree with this, I really have not found anybody in the league that I've seen have a ton of success guarding him in the post.
Yeah, you know, I think he's underrated physically, just from a strength standpoint. And I think one of the common things now you see across the league is you teams encourage sort of fours to post up wings or ones on switches. You know, James Harden loves guarding people in the post, and they think they can clown him on the block, but he's actually stronger than some of these bigs trying to post him, so they can't move him. But Towns can move everybody. And so when you're able to move people, you know, there's a great thing Kevin McHale always says, is when you have someone who's maybe undersized on you with your height and they might have equal strength, the key isn't just to back them down with your back to the basket and brutalize them that way. You have to start moving laterally, and so you get them shifting lifting. So when you turn your body, then that strength becomes that with that much more force. And because they're smaller, their point of leverage isn't as high. So you're basically just going to hit them high in the chest, and it's way harder for them to defend. Whereas if you back them down with your back to the basket, just straight line, then they can just sit down real low and use their quads and keep you from backing you down. And Towns is able to do that, A, and B, his ability to finish with both hands, I think, is really underrated. And so when you can't play a guy to one shoulder or the other, you know, there's a common double teaming tactic where, so let's say I'm the post feeder, or I'm guarding the post feeder, and the ball is thrown into the post, and my guy cuts through, and so I follow him, but as he clears to the weak side, then I whip around and come on the baseline and double team on the baseline side. And you do this when you know a guy likes to go that way to whatever shoulder, and so the guy who's guarding the post player will shade towards the, he'll like move towards the high side, and then the double will come from the baseline side. So you're encouraging basically to spin into the double. And so the difference, though, with Towns is you can't do that to him because you don't know which shoulder he's going to go. And so you can't really encourage him to go either way because he can hurt you in both ways. So I think that's really another underrated aspect of what he brings.
I think they're actually going to be okay offensively without Butler. I think that maybe they'll have a little bit more diversity at the end of games. Well, they have been a relatively decent clutch team this year. But this is the one advantage of some of these somewhat bizarre personnel moves that they've made, just getting all of this shot creation to the exclusion seemingly of nearly anything else except offensive rebounding on this team. They've got Crawford, they've got Jeff Teague, even Bielitsa is a guy who's probably underutilized from a shot creation standpoint. So I think they're actually going to be okay. I mean, if you look at some of their lineups without Butler, they've actually been pretty solid offensively. The problem, though, comes on the other end of the floor.
Exactly, and I totally agree with that. And they'll be fine, especially since Butler is not out the whole year. And even if he does stay out for a little while longer than they expect, it'll be enough time for them to get back into a rhythm and sort of figure it out. But yeah, I mean, defensively, obviously they've struggled all year. And you know, I think Towns has improved, and I think he's, you know, he has the physical tools to do what it takes. And I think he has.
Yeah. What's he better at, level, by the way? Quickly, you said he's improved. What's he looking better at to you?
So there was a play which I wrote about a few weeks ago, but basically so the idea of trapping the box, which we've talked about, sort of the primary help isolation, a lot of the times he wasn't really coming over in time because he was hugging up to the weak side, and then when he came over, he was late. And so you've talked about this on the pod before, not with me, but with Danny, about how they've sort of encouraged him to just be more active and go for everything. And sort of that activity level is putting him in the right position more often because he's pushing over more towards a strong side before the action happens. And then he's there in time. And so that ability, even if he's missing blocks and committing fouls and this and that, even if you're pushed over to the strong side, if you're pushed over to the strong side early, then the defense sees you and they're less likely to drive because they see bodies in the way. You know, we always used to talk about in coaching, see bodies, make sure they see bodies. So when you drive, you're thinking, oh, I got to go through 3-4 people versus, oh, I just got to go through one person. And I think he's really getting good at that. It's sort of understanding that I've got to move over to the strong side, or at least 2-9 in the middle of the paint, so everyone knows I'm here and I'm a presence. You don't have to be Rudy Gobert. You just have to be there.
Yeah. What do you see from him in pick and roll defense? That's kind of been the other criticism in addition to not getting over into help position.
Yeah, you know, I think he's better than people give him credit for. Again, active hands, pretty athletic, able to move his feet. It's really just a timing question, and it's really getting the rhythm down of when you're supposed to keep moving forward and then when you're supposed to start your backpedal, and then reading sort of the ball handler. You know, the best pick and roll defenders from a big standpoint aren't the ones that are able to swallow the ball or necessarily block shots or this and that. The best ones are able to sort of read the ball handler and understand what his decision making is going to be in each possession. So let's say I'm in a deep drop and the ball handler comes off the ball screen, and because I'm in that deep drop, I see the roller getting free. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of egg the ball handler on to throw that little pocket pass early because I know it's available to him and easy. And because I'm egging him on, I'm ready to then slide over to get to the big on the pocket pass easily. And so sort of having those nuances and understanding the strengths of the guys who are in the pick and roll, all that sort of gauges whether you're good to great or, you know, okay to good. And I think making those improvements just come with time and experience. And again, the more you play in the league, the more you play against the same guys and you understand the tendencies. And so then it becomes a lot easier to guard.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had Jim Boylan on a couple weeks ago, Bulls assistant. And one of the things I took away from him is something that just even from playing at a low level myself, and a lot of coaches, including you, talk about this, is the idea of just being one way help, and even in the pick and roll, being in a way in a position where if you're forcing that pass, you're there already in position to force that pass, and then as soon as that pass happens, you can be moving. If you're in a position where you're going one direction and then the action flows against the grain of the direction that you're moving, that's when it's really difficult. If you can kind of be there and be like, all right, as soon as this happens, I'm going to move here, that mentally it can seem to help a lot more.
Exactly. There's a phrase I really like, which is sort of, if you're guarding both, you're guarding neither, which is like, if you're stuck between the two, then you're at the mercy of the decision making of the offense. And on defense, you want to be the one sort of declaring to the offense, you know, we're not going to shut down on everything, but I'm guiding you this way, and you only have one way, and I know which way you're going to go, and so then it's easier for me to guard you, and then easier for us to rotate in behind. And so really keeping that sort of planned sort of directionality for your team makes it a lot easier for everybody.
Yeah, and then by contrast, offensively, I think the best guys are the ones who can really force a decision to be made with that big to say, all right, I'm going to engage you and force you to come over here, and then you can hit the role guy. But let's get back to the defense now for the Wolves. The stats without Jimmy Butler on the floor are ghastly. They are 16.3 points per 100 possessions better when he's on the floor per cleaning the glass. 11.2 points per possession of that is on the defensive end. Now, a lot of that, however, has just been bad luck to some degree when he's been off the floor. Teams are shooting 11% worse on twos outside the restricted area when he's on the floor, and 6% worse on threes. And while he could contribute to that some, a lot of that difference is going to be luck. But nonetheless, he's still really the one guy who's an experienced quality defensive player in their starting lineup outside of Taj Gibson. And the numbers really, when Butler is off, reflect that. Negative 3.6 net rating when Towns is on the floor and Butler is off. And then if you add Wiggins in to Towns with Butler off the floor, negative 7.6 net rating. And the defense in both of those situations is pretty ghastly.
Yeah, you know, the thing that I see, which is really tough as a coach because it's difficult for you to control, but they just don't do a good job of staying in front consistently and sort of having that controlled directionality of, if you're going to beat me, it's going to be a no middle drive, right? So I'm going to shade you away from the middle of the floor, and yeah, you might get a half a step, or we might be hip to hip, but you know that I know that help can come. And they're getting beaten too often. And you know, this is a thing that I always struggled with when trying to create a film session, or how much do you just beat, you know, like beat your team over the head with, we're getting beaten off the dribble, we're getting beaten off the dribble. Like, they get it, you know. I can show you 15 clips of the same guy getting beaten off the dribble over 5-game period, but what is that going to do to his confidence level? You know, how do I teach him to get better at staying in front? And you know, that's sort of on a player to player basis. But I think when you don't have the Rudy Gobert type in the middle, where you can afford to get beaten off the dribble sometimes, then you know, it becomes much more important that everybody can stay in front, and especially across multiple positions. And you know, I think back to those Chicago teams, really everybody on the team that played rotation minutes outside of, you know, the random 5'8" point guard that they had playing backup was, you know, they could all stay in front. You know, Derrick Rose at his peak athleticism could stay in front. Luol Deng could stay in front of everybody. Joakim Noah could stay in front of fours and fives. So,
and if they couldn't, they were at least sending the ball where it was supposed to
right.
go.
And so, you know, I'm sure, you know, that's something they emphasize. And again, I don't put it all, you put it some on the players and some of the coaches, sure, but who really knows? And I think it just comes down to the fact that they're young, and it's hard to stay in front when you're young because you don't know the tendencies as much of everybody. And I think hyperactivity can also lead to jittery feet, which leads to then it's, you know, sort of less stability. Like, one of the things I love, if you watch Draymond Green when he guards, he's just not moving a lot. Like, he just, a defender might, an offensive player might, a little hesitation, a little crossover, you know, body shimmer this way or that, but he's really not shifting his feet all that much. And then finally you make the move and he just slides a couple steps and he stays in front of you, right? And so I think when you think you have an athletic advantage, you almost get like over aggressive and over hyper on the ball. And so then one little jab throws you way far the wrong way. and then you get beaten. So I think all of that sort of contributes to this.
Yeah, and when some of these guys are vets too, like Crawford obviously has never been a good defensive player, and they don't have a ton of physical skills either. I mean, Bielitsa now started at the three against the Bulls. I mean, Wiggins is the one guy you could probably point to in their perimeter group who does have the physical tools. He's taken a few strides this year, but still has a long way to go, especially in some of his rotations as a help defender. But, you know, I think it's interesting for these guys. The biggest thing for me with Butler, yeah, on defense, having that one stopper against the other team's best player is important. But then also when you get into their depth, and with Bielitsa starting at the three, that's really, you know, he's not capable of guarding the best three or the best wing threat on the other team. So now if the best wing threat on the other team is a three, now you've got Bielitsa trying to guard the other team's two, which he's really, you know, at 6'9", 6'10", is probably too slow to do. Right. So that's going to be an issue. And then if you bring in Jamal Crawford for Bielitsa, which is probably how they're going to close games a lot of the time, you know, that's not exactly your defensive panacea either.
Exactly. And, you know, so it's tough. It's, I mean, 90% of NBA teams are making that choice between offense and defense towards the end of games. And really, with your lineup decisions throughout, it's very hard to find those two-way players. And I think we've talked about this before, but you really only get, you know, maybe your top three or four players are two-way guys. And then everybody else is pretty heavily leaning one way or the other. And so then it just becomes a question of, well, what do we need more and what do we play more? And, you know, at what point does becoming, I'm not sure what their defensive rating is right now, but let's say, what are they, probably like 25th or something in the NBA, right, I would guess?
Yeah, around there. I'll look it up while you're talking.
And so if they improve marginally from 25th to 20, like how much value is that versus becoming extremely good on offense and moving up from 5 to 1, you know, and really becoming so dominant there that the other team is more concerned about that end of the floor than they are about punishing you on the offensive end. And so I think when you have a dominance on one end, then it sort of shifts the mentality of the opponent into what we need to concern ourselves with, so much so that it almost helps the other end of your floor where you struggle.
You're perfectly right, by the way. 25th in defense per cleaning the glass, but they have the third ranked offense in the NBA, and that's why they have that plus 3.3 net rating. Quickly, you're familiar with Marcus Georges Hunt from your days in the G League. He's a guy who, of all the guys they have outside of Butler, probably the greatest potential to provide some modicum of two-way play on the wing. He didn't play at all in that game, really, against Chicago, the first one without Butler. He's gotten some spot minutes here and there, but he gives a quick scouting report on what you see from him.
Yeah, you know, he's very strong physically, moves his feet well, good defender, can shoot the three. But the biggest thing about him is he's a high IQ player. Last year when he played for Maine, Boston's D-League team, they really had a three-headed monster of Jalen Jones, him, and Abdul Nader, who's obviously now with the Celtics. But Marcus Georges Hunt was the one who's sort of the captain of the IQ and just controlling the offense and defensively taking the best perimeter player. And so he has that ability. Now, athletically, is he there for an NBA team? You know, I mean, there's a reason why he's, you know, barely scraping on the end of a roster. But I do like him in terms of what he brings mentally, and he understands the game. And he sort of had, I always thought he just had this calming presence on his team whenever he was on the floor. And so, you know, I'm not sure what he could contribute, but obviously, you know, I think he does have the tools to deserve a chance.
Yeah, and I think they are definitely going to be searching here. All right, we'll take a quick break, and we'll be back. I want to talk to Dylan about some proposals to allow younger players into the G League and how useful that'll be as an alternative to college, and then also a few other things we want to get to right after this. So I used to read a lot of nonfiction books, a lot of stuff to try and improve myself, and well, I found them useful. I also felt like, man, I just spent 10 hours reading this thing or 15 hours reading this thing. And yeah, I got something out of it. But really, what can you take away that you're going to apply to your life? You know, maybe you'll take away 10 things, 15 things, if you're lucky, out of this whole book. And it doesn't really seem like that efficient to spend all that time when you're only going to have a few key insights. And so when Blinkist came along, I was fascinated. I almost had the idea for that myself, not that I actually put it into practice. So I thought it was awesome. What they do is they give you the key insights of a book in a powerful pack that lasts just 15 minutes. If you have a 45-minute commute, you can get the insights from three books in the 45 minutes with Blinkist. They're constantly adding new titles, so you're always going to get the most powerful ideas. Just a few of the titles they have available right now: Emotional Agility by Susan David, The Worry-Free Mind by Bill Wade and Carol Kershaw Ed. Just a couple of what they have available. Blinkist is spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. And the way to get started with them is at blinkist.com/capspace. You can either start a free trial or you can get 3 months off of your yearly plan. That's blinkist.com/capspace. That lets them know that you came from us and get you a free trial or 3 months off when you join today. blinkist.com/capspace. So there's been this big scandal now with the FBI investigation, college players getting paid. Who knew? Shocked that gambling is going on in this establishment. But Mark Spears had a piece today saying, hey, you know what? Maybe these guys should go to the G League. They can get endorsement money right away. They don't have to go overseas. What are your thoughts in general? I mean, because remember now, if you're an 18-year-old coming out of high school, you're ineligible for the NBA draft. The idea would be you just go play in the G League instead of college for a year, and then you get drafted. What are your thoughts on that type of an arrangement?
I think there's a fundamental lack of understanding on what it is like to be a G League player. And people talk about the difficulty it can have for a guy to go from high school to the NBA. You know, you got to live on your own. You got to cook your own meals, all this and that. Yeah. But the NBA team has resources to help you. And, you know, they have team chefs and they have, you know, a strength coach and they have all this. Right now, I you know, one of my friends in the G League, the strength coach currently for the Fort Wayne Mad Ants, you know, there would be a strength coach on every team. You know, he told me that he doesn't think that every team has a strength coach quite yet. And so, you know, can you imagine just going to from high school to the NBA or to the G League, and then now you're no strength coach, and, you know, maybe you don't have it's not that easy to get to the gym per se, or, you know, it's not like an NBA arena where you can get in 24 hours. Maybe our gym's only open from X time to X time, and it costs money to Uber there every time, but I don't have a car, you know, and because I can't afford a car. So it's this whole thing of the resources have to be increased for the G League for that to make sense. And there's a reason why right now the process for using the G League as development is teams having their guy practice with the NBA team, lift with the NBA team, do nutrition, whatever else with the NBA team, and then just play games with the G League team. It's because you can get all of that better at the NBA level. The G League doesn't have the resources for that. So for a guy to go straight to the G League, I think you're losing out on what the college resources are, which are way greater than G League resources are right now. So I think, yeah, going straight, I think you should have the option. You know, I'm a believer, look, you turn 18, do whatever the hell you want, but just know that, you know, here's another example, which is any road trip in the G League is a 3-day event. So, you know, a lot of teams work on like a point system for lifts. Like you got to get, you know, 7 lifts a month or whatever, 8 lifts a month, and you don't get that, you get fined or something like that. So, but you go on a road trip and let's say you're flying from Fort Wayne, where I am right now, to Santa Cruz. Well, we're just going to spend all day today flying. Then the next day we're going to play a game. And then the following day we're going to spend all day flying back. And so you're just losing time, practice time, gym time, all of that. So all these things like just contribute to why I don't necessarily think that's a good idea until the G League is given the necessary resources.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some of these teams now have G League teams that are a lot closer, but even then you could be looking at two connections for a Fort Wayne to Santa Cruz, for example. Maybe only one, but still it's going to take quite a while. It's
because listen to this one. So we played Santa Cruz in the finals, and at the time we were an independent team, and so our resources were way less than the teams that had NBA ownership or, you know, whatever it's called, I forget. And so we flew from Fort Wayne to Chicago, then from Chicago to Denver, then from Denver to San Francisco, and then we took an hour bus from San Francisco to Santa Cruz, and that whole thing took like 15 hours. It was like insane. And this is just for the D League finals. So this is what it's like when you travel. Now, granted, you're playing a lot more games, teams that are closer, right? But, you know, how often does a team bus same day there and back to a NBA game? Never, right? You would never do that in the NBA, but that's a thing that we did sometimes. We had a 7 p.m. game in Grand Rapids, which is 2.5-3 hours away. We'd bus up on the same day and then bus back on the same day like it was college. So, that's, you know, that's just just another thing that's, you know, can be really difficult for these guys.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you a little bit more in a second about what it's like when the NBA player comes down and has to be integrated into the G League team. But my biggest concern, I've said this before on the pod, is, all right, even though there are these limitations in terms of development that you mentioned in the G League, I think it's still good to play with the NBA three-point line, NBA rules, you know, probably playing against tougher competition than NCAA. Some coaches, I think, are certainly better in the G League. Just learning what it's closer to NBA basketball than colleges.
Definitely.
But if you're an 18-year-old, and, you know, even if you're a guy who might project as a top 10 pick, and let's say you go, you end up getting assigned to the Austin Spurs. Well, the Spurs, there's no way they're going to be in a position to draft you. So, and they have other guys there that they're trying to develop. It doesn't really, they have no incentive to help you develop, to help you be it as an 18-year-old to figure out what it's like to not only just play professional basketball, but just become a man, develop you as a person. And so I think that's really a big problem, is there just isn't the incentive for a G League team, at least as the structure is now, to invest it in a guy when you know he's just going to be around for 1 year. And, you know, frankly, pretty much any 18-year-old, unless you're maybe like two or three guys a year, could actually contribute to winning basketball even in the G League if they were there.
Yeah, you know, I think that's totally right. It's, you know, I always enjoyed when first-round picks got assigned and they thought they had, you know, at least when we would play them, they would have this sort of like swagger about them, like they're coming and drop 35, and then all of a sudden they go 2 for 14 with 7 points, and they're like, whoa, this is way harder than I thought. You know, these guys are older. You know, I mean, D League obviously trends younger, but I mean, they're still 26, 27, 28 year olds who are just physically so much more mature than your average 18 year old. And so, you know, like you said, that's, you know, that makes a big difference. And, you know, I do think that it is possible, it is just something that has to be worked toward. But like, if I'm a college or if I'm a high school player and I'm graduating, would I rather just play for free for a year and get some development physically and all of that, or would I rather go to the G League and, you know, potentially not great circumstances with a team that's not invested in me and for an extra $25,000? Because that's all you're
gonna make. Well, I think the biggest idea, I think the biggest idea that Mark was saying, which is one that I agree with as well, you can at least like start getting some shoe money right now, or maybe, you know, your agent can front you a little bit, and, you know, you could at least, you know, it's not going to be just straight up $25,000. It might be, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars, or maybe. if you're a really a generational type of prospect, you do better. But then there's also always the hope of going overseas as well for more money than that. We'll see what the market looks like for that the next time someone tries to do an Emmanuel Mudiay or Brandon Jennings. And those teams probably even have generally have more resources than a G League team. So I think I would be much more on board with it if you had a way to align the incentives for the team to really want to help develop this guy both on and off the court. But I think there's just a very big risk of someone getting lost in the shuffle with the G League team.
Definitely. Yeah, I totally agree.
And maybe the solution ultimately would be, you know, allow guys to get drafted or signed much younger and have more of an academy European type of approach, or just keep the system relatively the same at this point, allow guys to be drafted, or you could just allow guys to be drafted right out of high school again, or you just allow guys to actually get endorsements and off-court income when they're in the NCAA. That would probably be my model, because the college just has so much going on economically. I don't know if you're going to be able to completely bypass college. But yeah, so the last thing I want to ask you about is, I mean, we touched on this a little bit, but just when you were in the G League, when you would have guys from the big team come down and get assigned, what was that process like, knowing that, all right, you know, we need to integrate this guy into the roster, but yet, you know, he's probably not going to help us win as much as the players who have been here this whole time?
Yeah, you know, it can be tough or it can be really easy, and it's really dependent on the player individually. And in my experience, I would say 90% of guys who got assigned understood the situation, were very friendly, were adaptive, and tried to learn as much as possible, and were not disruptive in any way. And the guys who were on the team, did they love it that their minutes were being taken? No. But they understood that this is what they signed up for by signing a contract with the G League, so this is sort of the situation. But we, you know, really it becomes easier when you get assignments from your own team. So as opposed to like the flex assignments for the various.
Oh, yeah, that was just crazy. I mean, so, the idea that like, oh, hey, you're from another organization, come on in here and, you know, take some minutes, help us lose some games. And, oh, by the way, we'll help a player with another organization get better.
Yeah, we had, well, when we were independent, we had 13 affiliates, and one time we had three assigned guys from three different teams, all trying to learn new terminology and all of that. But when you have the same team, we would, you know, go to training camp, or at least part of it, and our head coach was there the whole time, and he would adapt most of the offense, or at least large parts of the offense, to the G League, and we use the same terminology, so it wasn't a big adjustment in terms of learning plays or this and that, but just in terms of, like, you know, the interpersonal relationships, the guys, you know, they're professionals, and they understood what was going on, and you know, mostly I had great experiences with G League guys. I know one guy, Glenn Robinson, when he was assigned, you know, a lot of guys will say thank you after they leave the locker room because they're going to go right back up, or maybe they're there for a couple days at a time. But Glenn was coming off an injury, or I can't remember exactly why, but he got a one game assignment with us, and he played 40 minutes and he scored like 12 points, and he didn't shoot it well, and he didn't really play very well, and we lost. And, you know, after the game, he like made a point of giving a speech, pretty much a speech to the locker room, just thanking everybody for welcoming him and allowing him to come down. And he understood the situation that, you know, this sort of put everyone in. And, you know, I'd never seen anyone do that before to that degree. And that story, like, always sort of sticks out to me.
All right, I'll leave it up to you here. What are you more interested in talking about? Are you more interested in talking about Oklahoma City, Golden State, which you wrote a piece on, or the Blake Griffin, Andre Drummond dynamic in Detroit?
Well, you know, I'm more partial to the, you know, two big post spacing dynamics, but I think we can stick with OKC and GSW because there's a little more, you know, a little more there to discuss. But yeah, so we'll go with that.
Yeah. So I assume you watched the game over the weekend. You'd written a piece for The Athletic Bay Area discussing why it was that OKC had given Golden State so much trouble. So what had they been doing, and then what changed on Saturday?
So normally when you play a team like Golden State or Houston or someone with a very explosive offense that changes your typical defensive rules, what you do is you change your rules, right? You say, you know, normally we're going to try to tag the roller and close out to the three, but because they're so dangerous, we're going to let the roller go free and we're going to hug the three-point line, and if their rollers want to finish, they're going to finish. And while that sounds great in practice, what ends up happening is that your team is not used to this. So when it happens, you still sort of freak out when a roller is coming down the lane free, everybody collapses, and you get swing, swing, bang, wide open three. And so then you're getting neither thing, right? Instead of shutting off the three-point line, you're actually opening it up even further. And so what Oklahoma City is able to do is they don't bend their defensive rules for Golden State. And really, they play things the same way. They're always trying to tag rollers when they can. They're always closing out to the three. They're high pressure in pick and roll. Maybe, you know, Steven Adams is a couple steps higher to take away the pull-up. But in general, there's nothing new. A guy drives. They come over with hard help, trap the box, sink, fill, X out if necessary. And, you know, they're doing everything regular. And sort of in that back-end two-on-one situation, so if I drive down the right slot and help comes from the baseline side, then the guy who's on the weak side has now got two players. So there's one shooter in the corner Golden State will have, and one guy on the slot or the wing. And so another defender is standing there straddling both players. And because they're so long, like they'll have a Paul George there or a Josh Huestis or a Jeremy Grant or somebody like that, they're able to make that read and get deflections and steals and all that off the pass. Usually Golden State is great at making that pass, and that sort of initiates the ball movement, and then you're pretty screwed as a defense. But they're able to really make those passes difficult, both with the pressure on the ball and on the drive, so the passes are high arcing. And then in that two-on-one read, not only can they get deflections and steals, but then they can X out and rotate and contest hard, unlike most teams. And so they're not doing anything different, it's just they're able to sort of neutralize that aspect. And I think the other interesting part of it is, you know, this is something you've touched on before about how Steven Adams, because he's such a good offensive rebounder, you're almost able to get offensive rebounding and transition defense at the same time, because OKC doesn't send as many guys to the glass because they don't have to. But actually what I found is not only is that partially true, but anyone who's sort of available to offensive rebound will go for it. And they might send two or three guys to the glass just because they have that free reign. It's not sort of a coaching thing, I don't think. I think it's just, hey, if you think you can get it, go for it. And what happens is now that forces three or four Golden State players to box out or at least physically engage in the rebounding process. And so they get tips on rebounds and they get guys basically pinned underneath the free throw line. So instead of you having a clean transition break where guys are sprinting the wings, you're getting getting these long outlets. You've got a couple OKC guys back and nobody in Golden State running the floor. So then you have five guys basically sprinting out from beneath the free throw line as opposed to two guys from beneath the free throw line and three guys who have already crossed half court. So their ability to sort of attack the offensive glass and cause Golden State to concentrate more on defensive rebounding actually helps their transition defense as well.
Yeah, I think that that's there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, the biggest thing that I had focused in on, and you mentioned this, is just the OKC length, the intensity, the deflections. Paul George, I think, had like 5 and 6 steals in the first couple of games. And when Golden State has turns it over, and they are so boom or bust these days because their own transition defense is so bad that if they turn it over, I mean, basically any miss or turnover, that's been essentially the difference between, you know, their kind of, you know, top 5, top 8 defense this year and the defense that was, you know, top 1 the last 3 years or so, is they're just not getting back as well defensively now. And so if they're turning it over, and then you look at OKC, a team that loves to just run it down your throat, that really exacerbated a lot of their problems. So I think that just avoiding the turnovers in that game, then keeping OKC out of their own transition, and the Golden State defense looks a lot better when the ball is going in, and certainly when they're not turning it over. Is there anything else that you saw that really changed it in that game on Saturday?
Yeah, you know, the one thing I noticed, which is kind of small, but I think with 4 minutes left in the third quarter, it was still a 5-point game or a 4-point game, and then Golden State went on that tear and they were up 18, and OKC actually gave up 4 or 5 offensive rebounds in that span.
Yeah, by guards mostly, right? Yeah.
And 3 of them turned into 3s. And there's something that, you know, in film, when creating a film session, one of the things that I was always taught to do was you want to look for the cleanest examples of everything. So when, you know, a team runs a set and you want to show, okay, here are 3 clips of them running this set, you want to not just show makes of them running that set, but you want to show clean makes. So the ball swishing through the hoop and not just so it doesn't hit the rim and bounce around, because it just catches the eye and makes the eye pop a little bit more and saying, oh, wow, that was smoothly executed. And I think there's an aspect to that of really confidence and team confidence of when things operate cleanly on that level, it makes you grow in your confidence. And I think that's when the arena gets sort of loud and crazy. It's like, oh, Steph switched to 3. Oh, they got a dunk. And it's sort of these clean eye-popping moments. And OKC gave up the offensive rebounds, and then they gave up those sort of clean baskets. And not the sort of like, oh, you know, contested, the ball rattles around make. It was, you know, Nick Young swishing a 3 in the corner and shimmying. You know, it's these little moments that sort of create that group confidence, and that sort of push the game out of hand.
One of the things that was interesting about the second game these two teams played, which was an OKC blowout at Oracle earlier this month, Carmelo Anthony only played 5 minutes due to a sprained ankle. He was better scoring than Paul George and Russell Westbrook were. I don't think we need to talk too much about the OKC offensive struggles, but a lot of that was missed jumpers, and obviously Golden State was more locked in. But so Carmelo was the best of those three guys offensively in this game, but how much of their inability to have the same effect defensively do you think related to the fact that Carmelo was out there?
I don't think really very much, to be honest. And, you know, I don't think, yeah, is Carmelo the best defender of all time? Certainly not. But they were doing a great job defensively for the first 34 minutes of this game. And it was really just that little third quarter spurt that blew the game wide open. And to think that, I think at one point Russell Westbrook and Paul George were 2 for 20 and they were still down 5 points really speaks to how great their defense was doing, you know, regardless of how bad they were on offense. And the reason,
yeah, you know what, I disagree with you a little bit. I think Golden State really, I mean, especially Klay Thompson, he was getting like wide open 3-pointers in the first half that he was just missing, I felt like. And they had a lot. Russell Westbrook, I thought, had a lot of errors on Klay where he could have switched with Steph screening for him. I actually was not as impressed with their defense maybe as you were, not to argue. But hey, you know, that's what makes this podcast interesting. But yeah, I mean, but push back on that. I mean, what did you think was so good about what they were doing? Because I agree with you, the results, they were stopping him from scoring, but I felt like they didn't have the same sort of pressure. In fact, I'm not saying that's necessarily Carmelo, and they weren't forcing the same type of turnovers and problems for Golden State as they had in the first two games to me.
I thought the pressure, I agree, maybe wasn't as great, but what made that more noticeable was the fact that they weren't getting the deflection count that they were getting in the previous games. And so that made it feel like that the pressure was less. pass. But to me, what the sign of a good defensive possession is you don't allow penetration. And I thought they were not allowing penetration really at all. And that allowed them to force a lot of jump shots. And yes, Klay Thompson definitely missed some shots that he normally makes. But even considering those, and then you get, you know, a not piss poor performance in the first 2.5 quarters from Westbrook and Paul George, then you basically have a tie game, right? You take those two things combined. And so, yeah, Thompson maybe wasn't great, but neither was George and Westbrook. So those two together sort of neutralize each other in my mind. But I agree they were better in previous games, but they were still very good, I think.
Yeah, I think we'll have to agree to disagree on that one, although I can't say I went back and watched the film. On Carmelo, you know, they didn't go after him as much, but it is a difficult... The other thing I thought, I'm trying to think, was that in the first quarter or the first half or the second half, where you remember when Golden State ran like the same play 4 or 5 times in a row? It was kind of like... bringing Klay and KD out of the corner off a screen. Klay would usually cut backdoor, and then they would bring KD up to the wing.
Yeah, the stagger out of the corner. Yep.
Yeah. Why couldn't they guard that? And I can't remember whether that was in the first half or the second half, but I think at one point they scored 13 points on 5 possessions running that exact same play every time.
Well, I will preface this by saying that I think Paul George is the league's best wing defender, him and Robertson, and I guess Kawhi Leonard when he's healthy. But, you know, Paul George is an incredible defender, but he has this one bad habit of he shoots the gaps on screens all the time. Yeah. So because he's so long, he tries to sneak underneath to prevent the drive and then use his length to get around to contest. And when he's guarding Steph Curry, that's fine because he's actually long enough to prevent Curry. And Curry gets real frustrated. You can see it because he's open and then he catches it and then George is 8 foot arm comes out of nowhere and then he still can't get the shot off even though he seems open.
Yeah.
And so when he's guarding Curry, that's fine. But against Thompson and against Durant, sometimes he gets caught because he shoots the gap and then bang, a three is open. Or he shoots the gap, then they pump fake dribble and now George is in a trail position and now they've got the advantage. And so I think that contributed to it. And also, as you were talking about, so when you run that stagger screen out of the corner, so you have 2 screeners for one guy in the corner, but the first screener who's closest to the corner can either peel back towards the ball or he can backdoor cut, and so you really don't know what's going to happen with those bottom two players. And so Klay Thompson would curl off the first screen and he would bump into the defender as he did that, and so what that does is it mucks up the switch, and so that switch is not as clean, and then when you combine that with shooting the gap, then the guy's going to pop open on the three-point line. And so they kept doing that, and OKC kept shooting the gap and they kept getting burned on that, and so I think that's sort of what contributed to that play sort of struggling. But one thing before we moved on to Melo and all that stuff, I did want to say that our discussion right there of sort of disagreeing on what we saw in the film is a classic example of why halftime adjustments are so difficult, because you are looking at the game at one shot and you are taking notes and you think you see what's happening, and then you go back on film and what you thought happened isn't what actually happened, and so you're making adjustments based on your eyesight, which can be wrong. And so the best coaches are really able to see what happens and diagnose exactly what the problem is and fix it, as opposed to us. I don't know which one of us is right, but one of us is definitely wrong about our disagreement. And so if the wrong one was the coach, then we'd make an adjustment that's wrong and we're causing further problems. And so this is why halftime adjustments really aren't as easy as it seems when you say, oh, they just need to adjust and do this. Well, you're watching the game on TV and you can pause it and think about it and you don't have 8,000 things to think about. And so I think that's a really good illustration of that idea.
All right, we'll talk a little bit about this Griffin-Drummond dynamic in Detroit right after we do one more read here. So I am one of those lucky bastards who has never had to have glasses or contacts, but my fiance is in the opposite boat. She's always had to have contacts. And when Simple Contacts got in touch with us, I asked her if she wanted to do it, and she said sure. I sent her the link and she's like, well, I gotta do like 5 minutes here. And I'm like, yeah, that's right, 5 minutes, because they're giving you a vision test and they're letting you get your contacts off of that. So you just spent 5 minutes. You would have had to spend minimum 2 hours, probably more, making an appointment at the eye doctor's. If you work, you'd have to take time off to go during the day because they're not open generally at a time when people aren't working. You just take that online self-guided vision test, which is, of course, designed and reviewed by doctors, and then you can get access to their unbeatable contact lens prices. Although you should still get a periodic full eye health exam if what you're trying to do is just to get your prescription and get your contacts, Simple Contacts is just so much easier. That vision test is only $20. Again, much less expensive than you pay at the doctors. Shipping of the contact lenses is free, and my listeners can get $30 off their first Simple Contacts order. And you've got all kinds of options here. You can go to the vanity URL, simplecontacts.com/capspace, or you can just go to simplecontacts.com and enter that capspace code at checkout. Easy to remember, capspace. We talk about it all the time here on the program. Simplecontacts.com/capspace, or just enter code capspace at checkout. Get $30 off your contacts and let them know that you came from us. Yeah, so what's the story in Detroit now? We did our 15 and 60 on them yesterday, noting they had actually a worse net rating since Griffin arrived than they have overall for the season. But I did note that Andre Drummond's numbers are pretty consistent, actually. His usage is, I want to say it's actually even a little bit higher since Griffin arrived. They've had some nice chemistry at times. So what are they trying to do offensively to allow both of those guys to be effective?
You know, I think as everybody noted earlier in the year, Detroit's sort of offensive makeover, where instead of, you know, a lot of ball screen action, they were dumping it to the elbows and running elbow action, where you have either dribble handoffs out of the strong side corner, or you run that stagger game on the weak side and someone's backdoor cutting or popping up to the ball and then looking for a DHO to the weak side. And they were getting really good at that. But then when you get Blake Griffin, right, yeah, you can do some of that, but you're not maximizing him unless you give him the ball in isolation, right? You have to do that on some level when you have a player of his ability. And so I think one thing that, you know, they're struggling with, but improving pretty quickly, is that when Griffin has the ball in the block, where does Andre Drummond go, right? And so a lot of teams right now, when they have a post-up threat, he's generally surrounded by multiple shooters, so it's easy to just dot the three-point line and spread out. But Drummond, if he, you know, spaces out to the elbow or the three-point line, you know, that's no good, right? Because his defender is just going to sag off of him and double the ball with no consequence. And so what teams used to do, you know, 20 years ago when everyone had a post-up center, is you put the opposite big or the other big in the opposite dunker spot. And so then what that guy has to do is he has to read the post player. So if Griffin makes a move middle, then Drummond, who's sitting in the opposite dunker, is going to sneak along the baseline to the other side. But if Griffin makes a move baseline, then Drummond's got to circle up towards the dots. And so that what that does is, because Drummond's such a good offensive rebounder, his defender has to stay with Drummond as he's maneuvering within this post spacing, and he's going to start to basically block him out before the shot goes up. So what you're doing is you're basically getting your post ISO with the proper spacing, and then Drummond is just sitting there for offensive rebounds to tip things out and get in the way. And so I think they're really learning each other, and as Drummond gets more familiar with Griffin's post moves, he'll better be able to anticipate which direction Griffin's going, and then he can get in a better position for rebounds or little drop passes. But maintaining that spacing on a string, sort of like, if you know, middle to baseline and baseline to middle, is really important, and learning how to do that.
Where is Blake right now as a scorer and a post-up guy?
I mean, to me, he's still, you know, right up there in his ability. And I think, you know, one thing that's undervalued is that he's never really operated on a team where he's just been able to post with four shooters, right? He's always played with DeAndre Jordan and now Andre Drummond, and that's harder, you know, because you're going to have a guy sort of in your space. And I think he's proven that when he's given the space, he can really kill you. And, you know, the other part that's tough is they got to learn how to operate pick and roll when Blake Griffin is in the pick and roll. And I think, you know, I don't think many people disagree that Blake Griffin's a really good passer. And one thing he's really good at is when he catches that pocket pass and he throws that little lob up to DeAndre Jordan. But now Andre Drummond has to learn the spacing and of that dynamic. And so I think he's still really capable as a scorer, but it's just the team has to just get used to the new spacing dynamics, especially because Stan Van Gundy's always been a four out one in kind of guy, and now they don't really have that. But I still think he has that ability. Now, you know, obviously you guys have talked a lot about the, you know, the length of his contract, and will he be that level in 5 years? You know, probably not, but I think for now he still has it.
I will humbly disagree with you that I think his efficiency with the Pistons so far has been troubling, that I'm not sure that he's there anymore as just a dominant force in the post. And he is helped, I think, by the fact that Drummond is on the floor in some ways. Like, if he's playing as a center or in a four-out system, then the other team can just put their center on him, and I think he can't really score in the post against that center, and he's not quite dynamic enough to beat that guy off the dribble, and he's going to have to take a lot of long twos if he's ISOing against a guy like that. But I think his lack of explosion to me is becoming a little bit of a problem. If you look at his numbers, and this may improve, but if you look at his numbers since he's been a Piston, he's taking a lot of shots from floater range and shooting a very poor percentage on those. I think he's like about 30% on shots from that range since he became a Piston, and he's taking quite a bit of them. I think the Pistons are taking, I want to say, I'm remembering this from the 15 and 60 yesterday, the third most shots from floater range since he came onto the team, and they're 30th in the NBA in percentage from floater slash post up range. And I'm not sure that he has the explosiveness to really say, all right, we got to double this guy. Like, I think most teams now are at the point where they're okay just letting him go one-on-one and kind of living with it. But you don't see it that way, I take it?
No, I actually do agree with you, but I think it let me explain it this way, sort of a nuanced difference, which is that I think he shows that explosion, but as his skill level has increased, I think he's now becoming too reliant on him being a skill player versus his just explosive athleticism. I think often when you watch him post up, he'll half spin one way, half spin the other way, go up and under. It's just like 3, 4, 5 moves. And then sometimes you'll see it, he'll catch it, he'll just go power dribble, rise up, foul or dunk. And you do those simple plays, you know, where he pick and pop, catch a three, pump fake, drive hard, dunk. When he gets that, he looks like the old Blake Griffin. But I think too often he's trying to, you know, nuance his way to the basket and sort of finesse his way in there. And yes, he's a very skilled player, but it's not utilizing him to his maximum. And I think that's part of the problem too. You know, and one thing I will say, without being around him all the time, it's really hard to know, you know, whether that's just because he doesn't trust his athleticism anymore, as you suspect, or, you know, because he doesn't have it, or it's just because his skill level has changed. And I think that's one thing that's really hard as players with player development is, like, when you get good at a skill, then you want to just use that skill all the time. But, like, sometimes you have to remember what got you there in the first place.
Yeah, you remember, I think it was even 2-3 years ago now, in the Players Tribune, he wrote about, like, oh, how come you're not dunking anymore? And he kind of cited longevity type of reasons for that. And so, I mean, I think whether it's cancer or won't, I do think that at this point it's not happening enough. Those power moves with the type of undeniability that he used to have, you know, going back 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think that's sort of the sticking point of, like, will he be re-energized by being in Detroit, or will he just, you know, sort of continue on this path that he's been, which is still a very, very good player. But yeah, is it the Blake Griffin of 4 years ago? Maybe not.
All right, well, I think that'll do it for today. Thanks so much to Dylan for joining us. Don't forget about our sponsors today as well, Simple Contacts and Blinkist, a great way to support the pod. And Danny and I will return Tuesday night with The Gamer. Got 3 really interesting playoff race games to talk about, and of course catch up on news as well. Talk to you all next time. Till then.